for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Welcome back to our program. Paul Craig Roberts is with us. Paul Craig Roberts, a former senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, former editor with the Wall Street Journal. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. And you are suggesting that would I be accurate to characterize you as a conservative Republican?
Well, I was assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration.
Okay.
so
I don't mean that as a slur, sir.
Right. I suppose that's the way I would be seen. The question today is if there are any conservatives left. And that's the reason I hesitated. Neoconservatives are not conservatives.
Well, and this is the cleavage. This is the fault line. And you used to be an editor with the Wall Street Journal and with the National, and a contributing writer or editor with the National Review. And yet you're writing now about how the Bush administration is basically planning to be the first country in the history of the United States to initiate war with nuclear weapons against Iran and North Korea. This not only has to be making the folks in Iran and North Korea a little skittery and the rest of the planet, but I think most Americans would be shocked to hear this, and yet you suggest that you're simply reporting. This isn't an opinion piece.
Yes, I'm just reporting the Pentagon's own document. They have a document called the Doctrine for Joint Nuclear Operations, which calls for the use of nuclear weapons as a first strike option against non-nuclear adversaries in order, to quote them, in order to ensure success of United States and multinational operations. So I assume that when they take the heat in the world for coming out as a first strike threat, it's because of their announced threats, the continual threats come out of the administration to Iran, North Korea, and of course Syria. Since I wrote this piece, the last few days have been full of threats against Syria. I don't think they would use the weapons on Syria, but they certainly have no way of conducting any kind of military operation against Iran.
Now, because
with ground troops,
right? Because we just don't have the means to do it.
They don't have the means to do it, or against Korea. So I assume that's why the Pentagon has moved up this new option. Now, of course, it all could just be bluster and threat. It could just be designed to make Iran and North Korea do what we tell them to do. I don't think it will succeed.
But even as bluster and threat, correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that the last time that a, quote, democracy, end quote, and by that time you could argue that Germany was no longer a democracy, but in any case, the last time a major industrial power actually asserted the right to preemptive strikes was when Germany invaded Austria and then Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, and Poland.
Actually, the last time was when the United States invaded Iraq.
Well, yeah, okay, setting that aside. But I mean, basically, this is something that the Bush administration has created that has never been a part of American policy. 230-some-odd years it's never been a part of American policy, has it?
Our nuclear doctrine, it was always mutually assured destruction. It was to never be used.
In other words, it was defensive.
It was to block the other side from doing anything radical.
Right, defensive offense.
Yeah, so the notion, the MAD doctrine, as it was called, mutually assured destruction, the notion was it was to block the use of nuclear weapons.
Now, you suggest that it's the neoconservatives within this administration who are driving this pell-mell down-the-hill race towards not just war, but nuclear war, not just war, but first-strike war against North Korea, Iran, and apparently now Syria as well. What's their rationale? What's what part of their worldview makes this make sense to them?
Well, they are neo-Jacobins, like the French Revolution.
Could you explain for our listeners about the Jacobins during the French Revolution? What do you mean by that?
Well, the French Revolution, of course, totally different in its ideology than the American one. And the notion of the French was that to have a revolution, you had to, first of all, exterminate most of the existing classes or states. And then you had to force it on the rest of Europe. I mean, that's where the Napoleonic Wars came from.
Right, but even before Napoleon, within the French Revolution, the Jacobins, they did away with the calendar, and they renamed the months. They did away with all religions, and they came up with a new religion. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really tried to reinvent French society from the ground up. They named it Year Zero. Are you suggesting that the neocons are, like, in that mindset?
Well, they're in that mindset in the sense that they believe that America has all the virtue and therefore the right and the obligation to impose it on everyone else. They're very, very clear about this. They've written it over and over. And there's a wonderful book out by Professor Claes Wren called America the Virtuous, and it's about the neocons and how they came into positions of power and influence, and shows quite clearly what their worldview is. So they do, it is a notion that whatever they do is justified because they're acting in the name of virtue. We have the virtue, they have the virtue, no one else does. And so they are justified to impose it.
To what extent do you think that they might be influenced by the evangelicals among them who are rather outspokenly trying to bring about the rapture? And in order to bring about the rapture, first there has to be a world war, there has to be plagues, there has to be famine, all the predictions of Revelation have to be fulfilled, particularly Revelation 5.
Yeah, I don't think the neocons are influenced by the Christian evangelicals, but I think they find them very useful for starting war in the Middle East. And in that sense, they, you know, they have a common cause, but it's coming from two different kinds of ideology or thought. One of them is a religious fantasy, and the other is a rebirth of the Jacobin ideology. So they come to the same purpose, the same goal, but they haven't anything intellectually in common, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts, a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, a former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, contributing editor of National Review. If this is their worldview, I mean, the Jacobins had a pretty unpleasant outcome, ultimately. Robespierre paid for his crimes. What is the end game on this one? How do you see this thing playing out? And how are classic or traditional conservative Republicans like yourself responding to this? What can be done?
Well, you know, we point out the dangers. I mean, before it all started, I said it was a fantastic strategic blunder, or would be a strategic blunder. It has turned out to be that. We had just recently General Odom, who was the head of the National Security Agency under Reagan, during Reagan's second term, and he said it was the greatest that the invasion of Iraq and the consequences that are following from that is the greatest strategic disaster in United States history. And I think people are beginning to see that it's nothing but downside. I mean, we're certainly mired down. We can't control Iraq. And people are concerned that Bush doesn't show any awareness of this, and or he doesn't respond to the efforts to get some sort of way of winding this down. In fact, he sent Condi Rice just the other day to Princeton University, where she gave a speech that it's in our interest and our right to force democracy down the throats of the Muslims in order to save, his or her words, to save future American generations from insecurity and fear. And so she presented to Princeton within this last week the view that the Jacobin view that we have to protect ourselves by imposing ourselves on the rest of the world.
It's truly frightening. Paul Craig Roberts, you can find more of his writings, just simply put in quotes, Paul Craig Roberts, and Google it. He's all over the internet. Sir, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for sharing your audience.
I appreciate it. Good to have you on. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. You're light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
And ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office. Start my day.
It's George's song.
My zone is all protected, so I can be re-elected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the corporate crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way. The laws are theirs to break, long as I still get my take. My war chest keeps on growing each day. And taking care of business every day.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a reminder, America in Solidarity, this group speaking about the war's real and hidden cost to American families, will be Congressman Jim McDermott, Congressman Jay Inslee, Air America's Rachel Maddow, Gold Star Families for Peace's Karen Meredith, Nadia McCaffrey, and Annette Pritchard, as well as me. I'll be moderating the event in Seattle on Sunday, this coming Sunday. For more information, call 253-471-1123, 253-471-1123, or visit the website americasolidarity.com. So that should be fun, and we'll be doing this program live and remote from Seattle on Monday, more or less a week from the first day of next week, shall we say. That said, it is now time for our Piggy's Alert, yes.
£1 billion, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigot piggies in the starched white shirts?
Starched white shirts.
You'll find the bigot piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play.
As my friends, our Piggy Alert. It's a rather substantial one, actually. The juxtaposition of several stories in the news today. The first from the New York Times by David K. Johnson. After falling for 2 years, the share of income going to the richest slice of Americans. Now you know the Bush administration policies are working, right? The share of income going to the richest slice of Americans, the top tenth of 1%, grew significantly in 2003. Now it had been, kind of fallen under Bill Clinton's administration. They didn't like that. Grew significantly in 2003, while the share going to 99% of all other Americans fell. Tax data released yesterday showed. At the same time, the effective income tax rates paid by the top one-tenth of 1% income-wise fell sharply, declining at more than 10 times the rate reduction for middle-class taxpayers, the new report by the Internal Revenue Service showed. They go on to note the top 1% of taxpayers received almost 17.5% of all income. All paychecks in America, all income, went to the top 1%. 17.5% went to the top 1% of taxpayers. The top one-tenth of 1% of taxpayers in the United States had more income in 2003 than the bottom one-third of all taxpayers. They note this is a sharp change from 1979, the earliest year in the IRS report, when the total income of the poorest third of Americans exceeded that garnered by the top tenth of 1% by 2.5 to 1. So this is almost a 300% shift in the other direction. So there, that story, headlined at the very top, a surge in income, followed by an article from Reuters written by Bernd Duesman. Last year, according to government statistics, 1.1 million Americans fell below the poverty line. That equals the entire population of a major city like Dallas or Prague. Since 2000, the ranks of the poor have increased year by year by almost 5 million in total. 5 million in total. The poverty rate for whites has risen faster than that for blacks and Hispanics. This isn't just absolute numbers, although certainly it would be in absolute numbers as well. But the percentage, the rate of falling into poverty, this is cutting right across the board. Academic experts also say the government's figures minimize the true scale of poverty because they're outdated. David Brady, a Duke University professor who studies poverty, says every August, this is when these statistics come out, every August we Americans tell ourselves a lie, he says. Taking everything into account, the real rate is around 18%. The real rate of poverty in the United States are 48 million people. Poverty in the United States is far more widespread than in any other industrialized country. The article in Reuters goes on to note the well-paid, unskilled jobs in heavy industry, which once lifted working-class Americans into the middle class, are largely gone. And the decline continues. Since 2001, just by coincidence, the year George Bush came into power when he was appointed by five out of nine members of the Supreme Court, almost all of them appointed by his father or his father's boss, Ronald Reagan. Anyhow, since 2001, the United States has lost more than 2.7 million manufacturing jobs. Low-paid clerical work is being outsourced to developing countries. But wait, it gets even stranger. Bush's last tax policy, well, it's going to boggle your mind. I'll tell you about it after the break. Our phone number, 866-889-8894. It's 927. Tom Hartman here, helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I hear hurricanes are blowing. I know
there's change in the wind. It's called elections. And Tom DeLay indictments. And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, and here's where it gets even stranger, okay? We have the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, and some would say, hey, that's biblical, right? You know, the poor you will have with you always. Well, you know, that really wasn't the plan, and that really wasn't what Jesus was preaching or what the Old Testament prophets were teaching or what Muhammad was teaching or what Buddha was teaching or what Shiva was teaching. No, it wasn't. It was do something about poverty. It was do something about it. And you know, it's really interesting that you get conservatives who quote Ben Franklin accurately, by the way, and they make a good point. Ben Franklin comes along and you read Ben Franklin's autobiography. Actually, there's two good biographies out in print right now about Ben Franklin. Both of them are excellent. And I read one of them a year and a half ago, and I'm sorry I don't remember the title of it right now because they're all, it's about Ben Franklin, right? In fact, maybe that the title is just Ben Franklin. But in any case, You read Ben Franklin's autobiography, which I've read good chunks of, and there was this one time when he first visited England, and late 1740s, early 1750s, and he was absolutely shocked by the poverty that he saw, and that the response of the government had been to simply give people basically a welfare check. You know, it was the old Roman notion of bread and circus, that you keep a poor underclass, they provide cheap labor to those who own the means of supply and production. But you keep a poor underclass, but you keep them from revolting by keeping them, on the one hand, entertained, the circus, and on the other hand, fed. This was the mistake that, you know, the Jacobins, to go back to our discussion with Paul Craig Roberts, made, was they weren't feeding the French. There were food riots in France in the 1790s. I mean, food riots. Bread riots. People were climbing over each other. People were killing each other to get bread. While Marie Marie Antoinette and Louis the 16th were having lavish parties at Versailles. And everybody knew it. Sort of like Bush's inaugural ball. Well, just a mile away in Washington, D.C., there are people who literally are going to sleep hungry. So anyhow, Ben Franklin looked at the situation and said, if you simply give people food and keep them entertained, their children are going to grow up to say, oh, gee, the way to live is to get food and entertainment. And you're going to have multi-generational poverty. And he was right. And where LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, came along, and where Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, you know, we can break that cycle. And even Teddy Roosevelt, actually Teddy Roosevelt was the first guy to introduce the concept of breaking this cycle. Where they all, you know, with his discussion of a living wage, which went sort of a step beyond this, but I'll make my point on this first and then share with you. Old Teddy's thoughts on this. But the point was that if you give people a hand up, or a hand out, rather, if you give them a hand out, you also have to give them a hand up. If you don't also give them a hand up, then they simply become dependent upon the hand out. So how do you give them a hand up? Well, there's two ways. Number one, you ensure that if somebody is actually willing to work and able to work, if they're going to play by the rules, that they reap the rewards of the society. That is, they can actually raise their family. And this, of course, is antithetical to modern, is totally opposite of the worldview of modern conservatives who want to keep a terrified, poverty-stricken poor class rather than a middle class in the United States. And secondly, you provide for education. And this was what Thomas Jefferson was all about. It's why he started the University of Virginia as a free college. Anybody who could attend, regardless of their station in life. He thought that was such an important accomplishment that on his tombstone, he specified before he died, he didn't want it to say President of the United States. He wanted it to say founder of the University of Virginia. Because that was the future of this country. An educated populace could have enormous social mobility. And along with that, so you give the parents, who may be illiterate or uneducated or simply have a high school education and be, quote, unskilled, end quote, you give them an opportunity, if they play by the rules, if they show up for work and put in a 40-hour week, that they can actually raise their family in such a way that they can put their kids through school, they can cover their medical expenses, they can take a decent vacation, they can have their retirement, and they then will be able to raise children who go to college and who move into the professional classes and who form the upper middle class, and boom, you've got social mobility. Or they raise kids who can get a decent blue-collar job and continue to raise kids in the American dream. The American dream continues. There's Teddy Roosevelt. This is a recording made by Thomas Edison. Teddy Roosevelt talking about a living wage. We stand for a living wage.
Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Then he points out that a living wage is going to vary from place to place around the country, which is true. In some places, it's far more expensive to live than in others.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
But what makes up a living wage? What is it that has to be satisfied to have a living wage?
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living. Okay, Teddy, what is that? This is the Republican president of the United States that you're listening to, by the way.
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough to make morality possible. In other words, you don't have to steal to get the essentials of life.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education and recreation. You can put your kids through school, even through college.
To care for immature members of the family.
You can raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. 50% of all bankruptcies in America. This is the obscenity of this new bankruptcy bill that was passed this last year. 50% of all bankruptcies in America are from people wiped out by medical expenses. Half of them. Another third of all bankruptcies in the United States are single women who have been recently divorced, and they've lost the earning power of their husbands. And that's, I mean, that in aggregate, that's over three quarters of all the people who are filing for bankruptcy in the United States, and they all just got, you know, well, that's I'm digressing. Back to Teddy Roosevelt.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age. This is a living wage. But the cons would say, no, no. Living wage is $5.15 an hour or $6.25 an hour. And what are we seeing as a result of conservative economic policies? We're seeing an explosion in poverty in the United States. 1.1 million Americans. Think of the city that you live in. How many is a million people compared to your city? It's a big chunk of folks. 1.1 million Americans just last year fell into poverty. And you'll recall, well, you probably, actually, odds are nobody listening is old enough to remember, but it was the United States Supreme Court back in the 19-teens that declared, as Scalia and Thomas have implied, that a minimum wage, a federal minimum wage, is unconstitutional, that child labor laws are unconstitutional, that workplace protections are unconstitutional. Judge John Roberts saying things like endangered species being protected by the federal government is unconstitutional. All this stuff should be handled by the states. Yesterday, Dick Cheney saying to Rush Limbaugh, don't worry, this new nominee that we've got for the Supreme Court, she's going to be just like all the rest of them.
Right. Well, I'm confident that she has a conservative judicial philosophy that you'd be comfortable with, Rush. I've worked closely with Harriet for 5 years. I've seen her and worked closely with her, hand in glove with her, really, through this process of reviewing candidates for the Supreme Court. And that's how we got to the Roberts nomination. She believes very deeply in the importance of interpreting the Constitution and the laws as written. She won't legislate from the federal bench. And the president has great confidence in her judicial philosophy, has known her for many years. We're working on it.
Yeah,
you'll be proud of Harriet's record, Rush, trust me.
Yeah, you're going to be very kind. And Rush, of course, what is it all about? Undoing the New Deal. That is the agenda here. The New Deal. Minimum wage laws. The New Deal. Workplace protections. The 1935, the Wagner Act, the right to unionize. The New Deal. The New Deal. Social Security.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, see, you've got to understand, that's the bottom line for these guys. Roosevelt's New Deal is on the edge of dying because the cons like this very, very much. And then to top it all off, the last story I wanted to share with you, and I'll just give you a taste of this, and when we come back from the break, we'll wrap it up and I'll take a couple calls. 9 months into 2005, this is from the Wall Street Journal today, 9 months into 2005, U.S. companies have announced plans to bring back into the United States about $206 billion in foreign profits under a special one-year tax break. This is part of Bush's last big tax break for multinational corporations. A law signed by President Bush shortly before the 2004 election allows companies to transfer profits from overseas operations back to the U.S. this year at a special low tax rate of 5.25%. What are they going to use it for? Well, the Wall Street Journal says, some companies are even bringing home piles of cash while continuing to downsize. Colgate-Palmolive Company in New York said in July that it planned to repatriate $800 million at a time when the company is also pursuing plans to shut a third of its factories and eliminate roughly 12% of its workforce. Indeed. Telling the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
He's a cowboy president, but he wears a black hat.
Well, at least in the minds of most of us.
In America, can't get away with that. On the eve of destruction again, and he's got the knack. He's the cowboy president, but he wears a black hat.
And welcome back. 50 minutes past the hour, but coming up on just about 9 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This article from the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Tax break brings billions to U.S., but impact on hiring is unclear. In the article, they point out that U.S., just quoting from the Wall Street Journal, U.S. companies ultimately are expected to repatriate, that is, bring back into the United States, as much as $350 billion. That would be in profits. Now, put that number in your mind for just a minute, $350 billion. And consider, if you go to costofwar.com, National Priorities Project lists the cost of war in Iraq. And right now, the cost of war in Iraq stands at $198 billion, roughly $200 billion. So that's not even two-thirds of $350 billion. If I'm doing my math wrong, it's in the neighborhood of two-thirds of it. So, but just for less than the amount of profits that U.S. corporations are going to bring into the United States, $350 billion, for only $200 billion, you could have paid for an entire year of Head Start for 26,346,461 children. And we know Head Start produces huge results in kids doing better in school throughout their lives. You could have insured, we say we've got 40 million people in the United States uninsured, and many of them are children. You could have insured for 1 year with just $200 billion. Keep in mind, American corporations are going to bring back $350 billion at one-fifth the normal tax rate, at 5.25% instead of 25% tax rate. With just $200 billion, the cost of war in Iraq, we could have insured 119,111,300 children in the United States. That's more than there are uninsured kids in the whole country. With just the $200 billion we spent in Iraq so far, we could have hired 3,447,236 teachers and paid them for an entire year at full union salaries and benefits and the whole nine yards. 3.5 million teachers. And that's just $200 billion. But under Bush's new tax break, major corporations, they're going to bring back $350 billion and only pay 5.25% interest or taxes on that money. And this is mind-boggling. You say, well, okay, you know, that's all well and good, you know, public schools and all that. What about universities? Don't we need kids going to college? Sure. With the $198,916,000 we've spent so far in Iraq, roughly $200 billion, about two-thirds of what U.S. corporations are just going to bring home this year in profits. You could have provided full four-year scholarships at public universities for 9,643,000 students. Full four-year scholarships. 9,643,000 students. You don't think that that would have an impact on the future of America? A significant impact? See, that's the hand up. You give people a handout, you say, okay, we're going to take care of your generation, and we're going to give you a hand up. We're going to help you educate your kids. 9 million four-year scholarships. We could have built 1,791,000 public housing units, homes, for people who don't have homes, with just the money we've spent in Iraq so far, $198 billion. And what corporations are going to bring home this year at a super low tax rate, half again, or a third again larger than that amount of money. Say, well, you know, we have commitments beyond just the United States. What about global anti-hunger efforts? With just the money we've spent in Iraq so far, roughly $200 billion, we could have fully funded global anti-hunger efforts for a full 8 years. A full 8 years. We could have fully funded the worldwide AIDS program, wipe out AIDS on the planet. Fully funded with just the money we've spent in Iraq so far for 19 years. And again, American corporations are going to bring back into this country profits of $350 billion. This is what you could do with just the $200 billion that we've already spent in Iraq. We could have immunized every child in the world. You say, well, we're worried about the bird flu. Bush's response to the bird flu, is it, well, let's allocate a few million dollars or even $1 billion. Let's have a Manhattan Project to come up with antiviral drugs to help Americans if there's a bird flu or to develop a flu vaccine. No. His idea is we're going to do away with posse comitatus so that the army can come in and quarantine your city if somebody gets sick. I mean, how bizarre is that? But consider, we could have immunized, with just the money we've spent in Iraq, $198,916,375,000 so far as of this second, we could have immunized every child in the world with the whole spectrum of basic immunizations that are required for kids to go through school in the United States for 66 years. Every child in the world. Yeah, you know, you hear these members of the Congress, the Senate, and the House of Representatives throwing around the, well, we can find $100 billion here, we can find $100 billion, $160 billion. We're going to spend this year just on interest payments on the debt that just Ronald Reagan ran up when he was president, and transferred to his friends, his good buddies who were running Star Wars ideas. You know, the Cap Weinbergers and George Shultzes and whatnot. Don Rumsfeld, actually, his last job before he became defense secretary, a lobbyist for Star Wars. Trillions of dollars being, literally trillions, not an exaggeration, trillions of dollars being transferred to that military-industrial complex. And this is all that you could do with just $200 billion, just the money we've spent so far in Iraq. Just so far. And we look at this kind of money, and Bush says, you know, how are we going to pay for Katrina? We're going to cut our programs. He's going to cut 150 programs. Are any of them military? No. Are any of them programs that reduce taxes for corporations? No. Any of them subsidies for the oil industry? No, don't think so. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Those Democrats, they have no interest in giving Harriet Myers a fair hearing within an hour. Well, within 2 hours. By 10:16 a.m., after George Bush announced Harriet Myers at 8:01 a.m. on Monday, within 2 hours, Ken Mellman, chairman of the RNC, had sent out a Dear Republican email. I got one. You know, someday this is probably going to come back and bite me. Every year, I send $5 to the RNC. You know, I get a fundraiser, and I've got this little gold card that says I'm a member of the president's inner circle, and they give me certificates to hang on the wall and all kinds of cool stuff because I'm a donor to the RNC. And someday, it's like Harriet Myers, right? Everybody's all upset because all the Republicans are all upset because back in the 80s, Harriet Myers gave money to Democrats. Someday, somebody's going to say, you know that Tom Hartman, he gave money to the Republican Party. Got to watch out. But I do it. The reason I send them $5 every year is twofold. Number one, I send them $5 because it's enough to get on their lists. So I get all their stuff, so I know what they're up to. And number two, it's a small enough amount of money that it costs them more than $5 to send me all the junk they're going to send me, so I'm causing them to lose money by sending them the $5. In any case, I get this email from Ken Mellman to Dear Republican, which, you know, in his mind includes me, and he's the chairman of the RNC. And it says, before Ms. Myers was even announced, many Democrat groups said they would oppose her. Well, first of all, once again, and I don't know how often I have to say this. I mean, there was an article on the front page of the Oregonian, the newspaper here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, where I live, just last Thursday or Friday, by a regular news reporter, you know, saying the Democrat Party. There is no Democrat Party. It was a nice idea that Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich came up with back in the 80s to start referring to it as the Democrat Party. It was really a reinvention of something that had been first done by good old Joe McCarthy. And in fact, Herbert Hoover even picked up on it. But Joe McCarthy, first came up with the idea, and then these guys sort of, you know, they said, okay, well, that's a cool idea. Well, you know, we can do that kind of thing. And that is that if you say Democratic, it sounds a little too much like democracy. Can't have that. Can't have something that sounds like democracy. In fact, I think I may have, we'll just see here. I think I've got Joe McCarthy. This is when he was first using this.
Using not merely the communists, but the fellow travelers, the deluded liberals, the eggheads, and some of my good friends in both the Democrat and Republican Party.
Yes, the Democrat Party.
Who can become heroes overnight in the eyes of the left-wing press if they will join with the jackal pack.
Yes, join with Joe McCarthy, okay. So may he rest in peace. I say facetiously. In any case, number one, you've got what's-his-name, Ken Melman here, saying the Democrat Party. There's no such thing. It's the Democratic Party. But see, as Joe McCarthy said, Democrat sounds like, it rhymes with rat. It doesn't evoke images of democracy like Democratic does. But the name of the party, as it was named by Thomas Jefferson, back then it was called the Democratic Republicans. In the 1820s, they dropped the word Republican, and there was no Republican Party until the 1850s. 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, the thing was founded. But anyhow, it was named by Thomas Jefferson as the Democratic Party, and still is. So keep an eye out. This was this big campaign by Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich to stop using the word Democratic and simply say the word Democrat. So anyhow, before Ms. Myers had even announced, many Democrat groups said they would oppose her. Well, two problems with this. Number one, it's Democratic, the Democratic Party. It's the official name. Number two, not one single Democratic group, not one single group associated with the Democratic Party, not one had announced that they were going to oppose Harriet Myers. In fact, Harry Reid, the Senate Democratic leader, had come out and said that he liked her. Melman, this email from Ken Melman, he's saying, call your senators, sign a petition, call radio talk shows, write letters to newspapers. He says the Democrats have, he says, quote, they're promising to throw every punch and make every accusation. They have no interest in giving Ms. Myers a fair hearing or vote, end quote. Sorry. Hasn't happened. I mean, even Eleanor Smeal of the Feminist Majority says, you know, let's wait and see how she answers the questions. Don't confirm her if she won't answer tougher questions about abortion. But, I mean, nobody had come up. So, it's interesting. It's interesting to see the way, you know, the whole spin on this thing. In fact, actually, the people who were opposing her were the Republicans themselves. You had the National Review. You had David Frum. You had Michelle Malkin. I mean, all these folks are coming out. Hey, we can't have this. This is terrible. She's not a real conservative. A.K.A. she's not a fascist. Turns out maybe she is. She was the filter through which George Bush got every piece of paper in 2003, including the infamous memo that said Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. That's the photo of her that's showing all over the country. She's argued in favor of Alberto Gonzalez's notion. In fact, may have even been a participant in the architecture of this, in creating this, of Gonzalez's notion that, well, you know, traditionally we had people who had rights go back to 1215, I think it was, in Runnymede Meadow there in central England, where King John was confronted by the feudal lords, and they said, you're going to sign this Magna Carta or you're toast. We're not going to let you play king anymore. And he signed it. So you've got the people who have rights. And during time of war, soldiers, yeah, they give up their normal civilian rights, but they also have rights. And the reason why we want soldiers to have rights under the Geneva Conventions, and there's been a series of them now, five of them, I believe. The reason that we want soldiers to have rights is because we want our soldiers to have rights under the Geneva Convention if and when they're captured in a theater of battle. It's called self-interest. Illuminated self-interest. It's just very simple. We want soldiers to have rights. So anyway, you've got these two categories. You've got civilians who have rights under the Constitution, the right to a fair trial, the right to a speedy trial, the right to trial by jury, and you have soldiers who are covered by the Geneva Conventions, which means that they can't be humiliated, they can't be tortured, they have the right to see a lawyer. They have a right to a trial if they're going to be charged with the law, and you know, when hostilities are over, they have the right to be freed. And you know, last I looked, Bush was essentially declaring victory in Iraq or in Afghanistan. Look, we've got elections going on. Now you could argue the war is going on, but were these actually combatants that we're holding in our concentration camp down in Guantanamo Bay? If so, let's give them a trial. Let's find out. If they're people who did horrible things, let's hold them accountable for that. But anyhow, Harriet Myers, one of the architects of the idea that, no, there's a third category of persons. They're not soldiers under the Geneva Convention or even spies under the Geneva Conventions who have far fewer protections. They can be executed during time of war. And they're not civilians. They're a brand new category. They invented the phrase out of whole cloth, made it up out of thin air. They're enemy combatants. Sort of like Hitler. With his, we have Untermenschen. They're not quite humans. They're just below humans. They don't have human rights. The subhumans. And these subhumans are staging a hunger strike right now in Guantanamo Bay, by the way. And they're starting to look, according to the few attorneys who've been able to get in and see some of these guys, there's over 100 of them now, starving themselves. They're starting to look like they just got out of Dachau. So Harriet Myers apparently thought that was just fine. She's been a lawyer for Microsoft and Disney. She's, you know, on the corporate side, on the fascist side. And apparently we learn now from today's New York Times, a born-again Christian, not that that should disqualify anybody, but that she has been rather active in the anti-abortion circles within that community. And so thus, Cheney can say to Limbaugh, don't worry, Rush, everything's going to be fine. Your corporate interests are going to be protected and the right-wingers are going to be covered too. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same.
And they vote all the same, too, yes. The Republican paradise, all those little boxes. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Mike in Dayton, Ohio on the line. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've just been thinking about, you know, that all the discussion with the justices on the Supreme Court, and you hear a lot with the Federalist Society and strict constructualism and everything. It seems to me, you know, that nowhere in the Constitution, they don't seem to like the penumbral rights, or the so-called rights to privacy or anything else, but how did corporations get the rights? What about all those court cases that gave the corporations rights. What about we go back and revisit those if we're going to go back and revisit rights?
Mike, I wrote an entire book about that. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and it goes all the way back to the first Supreme Court case that everyone says gave corporations the rights of persons, which was in 1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad. And it turns out, when I actually read the case, and I don't think anybody had actually read the case in 100 years, because everybody was referring to the headnote, which is a commentary on the case, which was written by John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court back then, who was a former railroad president. This was a railroad case. And the railroads were asserting that they should have personhood rights in order to tromp on or trounce local, you know, county tax officials. That the clerk of the court said, corporations are persons and entitled to protection under the 14th Amendment. But if you actually read the decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, it says no such thing. And in fact, we went back to the National Archives when I was writing this book. This was about 4 years ago. Went back to the National Archives and found the library for the Chief Justice at that time. And in his own hand, we found the Chief Justice writing to Davis saying, we did not decide that corporations have rights. And the photograph of that correspondence is on my website. So, yeah, I'm all in favor of that. I think that we should be rolling back corporate personhood is what it's called.
I mean, didn't it way back that when corporations were started, I've done some like writing and things like that, that corporations were just given charters for specific things for specific periods of time, and that was it.
That was the law in the United States up until, well, basically until the Civil War. And Lincoln loosened a whole bunch of laws. There were most of these laws were state laws, but Lincoln loosened even some of the state laws in order to allow corporations to today what would be considered break antitrust violations in order to produce war material. And he gave all kinds of loopholes to the railroads. But then the real explosion happened during what's referred to as the charter-mongering era, and that was the late 1800s. What happened was John Rockefeller was cornering the oil market, and he was doing it primarily by buying up all his competitors. And if they didn't go along with him, he had a deal with the railroads, who were incredibly corrupt in that period of time in the 1880s. He had a deal with in the 1890s. He had a deal with the railroads where they would charge higher prices for his competitors to transport their stuff. And he was just, you know, putting people out of business, all of his competitors, and then buying them up cheap. And the ones who were strong, he was bringing them into this trust. It was called the Standard Oil Trust. Well, this was against the law in the state of Ohio. So the state of Ohio said to Rockefeller, you can't do this. And, you know, we're going to put you in jail if you keep doing this. So Rockefeller said, what state is willing to change their laws to allow this? Because not one state in the Union allowed this. Up until that point, in every state in the United States, a corporation could only exist for the lifespan of a productive lifespan of a human being, which was varying. It varied from state, but it was typically 30, 40, or 50 years. A corporation had to be dissolved at the end of that time. A corporation could only do one single thing. It couldn't do multiple things. If you wanted to do something else, you had to start another corporation. A corporation's officers and directors could be held personally responsible for the behavior of the corporation. The first purpose that a corporation was incorporated for had to be to serve the public good, and the second purpose was to do whatever they're going to do, build match boxes or railroads or whatever, and so on. And so Rockefeller said, what state wants to change their laws to let what I'm doing be legal? Whatever state that is, I'll pay an enormous amount of tax to them. And New Jersey said, we'll change our laws. And then New York said, well, we'll change our laws. And then Connecticut said, well, we'll change our laws. And then Delaware said, we'll change our laws. And this competition started among the states, this race to the bottom that lasted over about a 10-year period from the mid-1880s to mid-1890s. It's referred to in history as the charter-mongering era. The state charters, the corporate charter laws in the states were all being changed all across the United States. Rockefeller moved to New Jersey, which is why it's even today called Standard Oil of New Jersey. And, you know, the rest is history. So that was the turning point. And when Teddy Roosevelt came in, he tried to undo that. 1907, Roosevelt actually got a law passed that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to politicians. And, you know, there was a real serious effort on the part of the Republican Roosevelt to roll that back. But ultimately, it's been unsuccessful. And so here we are with this mess that we have, Mike. Does that make sense?
The history it doesn't teach that too much these days. So.
Well, it's all there to find. It's yeah. you read some of it in Carl Sandburg's biography of Lincoln. There's some of it in there's some great histories of the history of oil, the history of the railroads. I mean, it wasn't difficult when I was writing Unequal Protection to pull all this stuff together. It's just that you're right. Textbooks, you know, in our schools, they don't talk about this. It's basically the history of presidents, and even those are incredibly sanitized. But, you know, that's the history of modern America right now at least the last 100 years, is the history of corporate power. And it's the history of the gradual and but steady erosion of human rights in the United States and the rise of corporate dominance, very simply. And as we say, okay, corporations should have First Amendment free speech rights. I mean, what does that do to us? Because a corporation, if their free speech is money, they have, you know, potentially infinite amounts of, or relatively speaking, huge amounts of money. How can you have a level playing field when you got a corporation with billions of dollars that they can use as speech, and you've got a mouth that can only speak as loud as it can speak? I mean, that's a... Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Get me on a rant here. There's a lot more where that came from. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been?
Yeah, what is this, Harriet Myers song?
Since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, welcome home.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the true people's radio, truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. As in, yeah, double entendre, yeah, as in, let's change this country. Larry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, yeah, glad to hear you talk. I was the first Fulbright scholar when I graduated Juilliard with Aaron Copland to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And so my people were from Tuscany, and I became very interested in history. I don't know if you know that many years ago, two professors from the University of Philadelphia published a book called Storia, which means story in Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out many wonderful things about Jefferson and the people before Jefferson and all the Italians by the hundreds who helped in the Revolutionary War. But the biggest thing people don't realize that when Jefferson was faced with writing the Declaration of Independence, according to them, he was so tired of being away from his wife, he wanted to spend time with her, and he had his neighbor, who was Dr. Matsey, who was a doctor of agriculture, and also Jefferson was interested in the Italian language because he had all these Italian workers build his Monticello for him, and they had to be musicians besides, which I am myself. So became more interested. So Dr. Matsey wrote the Declaration of Independence in Italian, and Jefferson, through translate, changed it. The state of Virginia, although adopted as it was written in Italian and translated into English.
Well, theory, Larry, but, you know, a lot of the language that's in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson had written 2.5 years earlier in Summary Review of the Rights of British Americans.
Well, it might be worth looking into.
When he was in Virginia.
So. Yeah, but one more thing was that this neighbor of his influenced him in the language. He wanted, and then Jefferson to go to Italy, of course, because he loved the Italians and the music and all that.
Yeah, Jefferson spoke six languages.
Right, and when he founded the University of Virginia, the requirement for every student, no matter what they majored in, until a few years ago, they had to take 2 years of Italian.
Hmm.
People don't know this.
Well, that's marvelous. That's marvelous.
And a lot of things of that era, they might look into that book. I don't know if it's still published, but it gives you a lot of insight at what really happened, who helped during the Revolutionary War.
Sounds fascinating, Larry, and thank you for sharing that with us. In fact, when we first moved into Montpelier, Vermont, this was 5-6 years ago, we bought a house that was built in 1850, and up in the attic, there was a whole bunch of books from the 20s that had been unmoved and they were ruined by the weather. But there was a complete collection of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, which has only been published once in the history of the United States. It's published in 1904, I believe, maybe 1909, by the Thomas Jefferson Association, which is now disbanded. And I started reading this thing, and it is 20 volumes. Got so into it, I ended up writing a book about the things that I learned about Jefferson from his own hand, because it included his diary, his personal diary, which he never intended to be published, all of his personal correspondences, and that book is called What Would Jefferson Do? So if you're a Jefferson junkie, you might want to check that out. The Random House publishes it. It just came out in paperback this month, in fact, in fine bookstores all across America. Armin in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, not to change the subject, but...
Go for it.
I'd be curious to know, I have a good idea, but I'm sure you can get the statistics better than I can, how many good private sector jobs we've lost to date since Orwell Bush has been in office, and further.
Well, we know it's been about 2.1 to 2.4 million manufacturing jobs, but in total, it would have to be 5, 6 million at least, I would guess. But I don't know.
Good ones, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really good things.
Yeah, replaced by Walmart jobs. Walmart is now the largest employer in America. GM used to be. That's the metaphor for the change in America, you know, as well as the reality.
Yeah, and he's supposed to be the privatization king. And further, at the same time, wouldn't you love to know how much government employment has increased?
It's increased substantially. Yeah, Bill Clinton actually reduced government payroll by a total of almost 300,000 people. He actually shrank the size of government. George W. Bush has increased government at a rate and in absolute numbers larger and faster than any other president in the history of the United States. So, yeah, good point, Armin, and thanks for bringing it up. It's always great to hear from you. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, what's on your mind today? What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to chime in. I had that guy talking about corporate personhood, and I just wanted to tell everybody, and you told him about your book. It's a fabulous book on equal protection. I recommend it to everybody, and I've read it like 3 times, and I go back and look stuff up, and it is a really great book, and it's a really good eye-opener. And then the next caller is talking about Jefferson. What would Jefferson do? That's another fabulous book that you have. And I also just wanted to say one quick thing about...
Bless you, Amy. We'll have to send you $5.
Oh, I love those books so much. To the caller about the corporate personhood, he should get involved with Reclaim Democracy. Jeff Melchin,
right. ReclaimDemocracy.org is their website.
Yes, and he sets up chapters. There's a newly set up chapter in Orange County here. I was going to do one in San Diego, but then I got involved with the publicly funded campaign, so that's my passion now. But I forgot what I was going to say. But anyways, I just wanted to tell people, like you always do, just get involved and just, find an organization. If there's not one, make one up.
Yeah, I would guess where you were going, Amy, is pretty much any topic you want to bring up, any of the dimensions.
Yes, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, all these different abuses of the Bush administration, they all ultimately go back to corporate power.
Yes, they absolutely do. And I just wanted to give you one last comment. I love listening to you on the radio. You're like having a beer with your favorite history professor. And I just love your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Amy. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Tom.
And hopefully it's more entertaining than your favorite history professor. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
I was listening to you about the campaign fund. Isn't it ironic that a person is only allowed, if they have it, give their own kids $10,000 tax-free?
That's right.
Yet you can donate as much as you want if you're the rich to a politician.
Well, actually there's a limit of $2,500 in hard money.
Well,
or maybe it's $2,000.
If they could tax the funds that went in, like the Republican or Democrat Party. Democratic Party, and use that tax money for the border patrol, that would be self-sufficient.
Well, let me tell you, Jim, you could actually do away with the Border Patrol. You could take down the fences. You could do away with all... You could get rid of everything that's down there that's designed to stop illegal immigration.
And you'll still have it.
No. And solve the problem. Because if you think... You know, my guess is, Jim, that I don't know how old you are, but you're probably old enough to remember the 60s and the 70s anyway.
When I want to go further back than that one of my next incident. I want to tell you about.
Well, if you can remember the 50s even, you'll recall that there was not a problem with illegal immigration.
Right.
And yet we didn't have fences. We didn't have these super fences, and we didn't have monitors, and we didn't have airplanes flying up and down the border and all these things to stop people from coming in. Now, why is it that we didn't have a problem with illegal immigration then and we do now? The reason is very simple, because back then you had more than a quarter, 30-35% of the American workforce was unionized, and which means that 70-75% more or less of Americans had basically union or union-type jobs, and that provided the first barrier for entry into the workplace. It was basically workers looking out for themselves. And if illegal immigrants tried to get into those workplaces, the unions themselves would act as a barrier to that. That, number one. And number two, there wasn't this outside of farm labor, and mostly in California and up and down the West Coast, outside of that one exception where illegal immigrant labor was still being used. Outside of that, there wasn't a broad swath of American job opportunities for people who were willing to work for minimum wage. It was basically, I mean, like me, when I was 13 years old in what, 1962, I got a job flipping hamburgers at Henry's. You know, it's an early competitor of McDonald's. I mean, and you know, I was able, my wife and I both put ourselves through school, you know, through college, working. And you could actually, you know, work a cheap job and pay for college. You can't do that now. And
right.
So
the textile industry used to get raided all the time, and they would export the illegal, you know, aliens.
Yeah, they'd get rid of them. If you want to stop illegal immigration into the United States, you don't have to have border patrols. You don't have to have more cops. You don't have to have vigilantes. All you have to do is enforce a law that says that any CEO of any company that's caught with even one illegal immigrant working for them goes to jail for 1 year. And
well,
the day after that law starts being enforced, you'll have 10 million people standing on the border with Mexico trying to get back into Mexico.
Right. Last night's president's speech, he hit on the Asian chickens that are going to bring the disease.
Yeah, bird flu.
And he wants to put the military in charge.
I know, it's nuts. George Bush's solution to everything is the military.
Are we going back to the Pinkerton police?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're already there. It's you've got Blackwater Contractors in New Orleans.
This is something to think about. Yeah, those people in New Orleans are survivors of a tornado. They're not criminals. And they're not, you know, whatever they want to make them out to be.
Yeah.
These people were, they're not refugees either. They got blowed out of their houses, and then the military comes in, confiscates their guns, then takes over on top of the National Guard. And these were Halliburton mercenaries.
I know. Well, it's not Halliburton, it's Blackwater. But, you know, good point you raised, Jim, and it's got a lot of people very concerned. Why do we have paid mercenaries, professional killers, down there in New Orleans guarding the... And for that matter, why did the media buy into so quickly and so easily the black folks gone wild story that the media was putting out that was a phony story? There were great acts of compassion and charity and help in the Superdome and in the Civic Center in New Orleans. There were not rapes happening. There were not murders happening. They didn't find any bodies other than people who had died of natural causes. One single exception to that. You know, one person who apparently was the victim of foul play. Why did the media just, you know, lurch at this thing? Well, it served the interests of this whole basically white power structure in the United States. Not a healthy thing. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Yes. Bring me another rum punch here. 50 minutes past the hour. 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, it's... you get George W. Bush, this whole Planegate thing. Of course, you all remember the infamous moment.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
The whole investigation into who committed treason. Well, it turns out that Deputy Attorney General James Comey, I'm assuming it's pronounced Comey, C-O-M-E-Y, was the guy who hired Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, and he was the guy who was supervising Fitzgerald. He was basically Fitzgerald's boss. Well, just by coincidence, Lockheed Martin, a company that I'm sure has no connection at all to the Carlyle Group of the Bush family, just by coincidence, Lockheed Martin just offered James Comey such a great job he couldn't turn it down. And so he's leaving as Patrick Fitzgerald's boss, and is going to be replaced by a guy named Robert McCallum, who, according to Newsweek, no, I'm not quoting some nutcase blog, this is Newsweek, quote, Robert McCallum, quote, a member of President Bush's Skull and Bones class at Yale. End quote. Not just a Skull and Bones member, not just a Yale graduate, but a guy who was in the club with George W. is now going to be the boss of Patrick Fitzgerald, the guy who is supposed to be prosecuting Treasongate. Doesn't that just make your day? Check out the 15th August issue of Newsweek. This is, you know, a while ago, talking about this. Well, it's happening now. It's happening now. 1-866-889-8894. Kevin in Washington, D.C. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, it's Kevin. Yes, I just want to point out how the conservatives are basically shooting themselves in the foot when they basically cut all these, let's say, humane programs like, you know, lunch programs in schools and health care and things of that nature. During World War II, one of the biggest problems for national security is that we didn't have a fighting force healthy enough to go out and fight. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what implemented the school lunch programs and the breakfast programs and stuff like that.
Because so many soldiers
were turned down because they lived in rural areas that were basically...
They were malnourished.
Yes. And they had to turn them away.
And that was the genesis of school lunch programs throughout the country?
Yes.
If you can get a link on that, I'd love to know more about the history of that. If you'd email it to me, I'd really appreciate it, Kevin. You know, my email address is tomthor@tomhartman.com.
Matter of fact, Nixon expanded the program.
Yeah, I knew that Nixon had... I thought it had originated during the Nixon administration.
No.
Interesting.
No.
Okay, yeah, send me that information. My email address is right there on my website. Easy to find.
Okay, then.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. I appreciate it. Amazing that we've got the smartest listeners in the entire world. I'm continuously impressed. Charisse, and is it Polesbo, Washington?
Yep.
Hey, Charisse, what's up?
Hi. I have a little comment. I think we need to look at the performance of our congressmen in a different context. If a fireman, a paid public servant, stood by and watched a building burn, he would be derelict in his duties.
Right.
He would be despised by the public who are paying his salary to care for them.
Yeah.
In the same sense, we're paying congressmen to do a job by representing and caring for us, but they're not doing it. They've done nothing but legislate this country into horrible fiscal irresponsibility. I was reading economic websites last night.
Yeah,
Center for Public Policy something
sure.
or other. It was horrid.
Yeah.
And you know, we're hated globally for our foreign policy. I was in an argument with my father-in-law, who's a strict Republican. I said, Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. I can't stand feeling so vulnerable and insecure. Our debts to China, our foreign debt, our this debt, our that debt, you know. Nothing seems like
it. But you see, you have to, Charisse, pardon my interrupting you, but you have to understand, in their worldview, that insecurity that you feel is called freedom.
Ugh.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious.
Yeah.
In their worldview, and this is where Franklin Roosevelt took them on. He said, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. If your necessities are not being met, you're not free. And Roosevelt laid that out, and Americans said, yes, we understand, because it was the depths of the Great Depression. But before Roosevelt said that, the predominant meme in the United States, and Reagan brought it back, and now it's once again the predominant meme in the United States, is that you have the right to be hungry. You have the freedom to be hungry. You have the freedom to work four jobs at Walmart at the same time, at Walmart and various other, you know, low-wage jobs in order to try and make it through. You have the right to declare bankruptcy, sort of, maybe, if you can't pay your medical bills. And is that the cons will take that and with seriously, I mean, they and with a straight face, because they really and truly believe it. And they will say, if the government takes our money, and really they say your money, but they really mean rich people's money. If the government takes our money and redistributes it to people who need it so that you don't have that insecurity, so that people do have secure pensions or a secure Social Security system or Medicare covers everybody in America, we have a single-payer health care system. If the government does that, that means we're less free because they're taking our tax dollars. That's the meme that they're spreading. And people have to realize Roosevelt was right. You're not free if you're living in terror. If you're living in terror of becoming sick because you can't pay for it, if you're living in terror of not being able to buy food, I mean, that's the bottom line. Make sense, Charisse?
Yeah, so explain to me, how could they possibly even think of reprimanding those police officers in New Orleans when...
Reprimanding?
For being AWOL during Katrina when they had to run and see if their families were dying.
Well, I agree with you, and time will play that one out. I frankly don't know what's happening yet with that, and I think that they're probably still trying to sort it out. The main problem, I think, was that the police chief was repeating the black folks gone wild meme or story, which was such a destructive story, such a wrong story. And he should have known better. And I think that's why a ton of bricks is coming down on him. But that's just my personal guess. Thanks for the call, Cherise. Great to hear from you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here exposing the con in conservative.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital. Broadcast syndicated by Air America Radio now, carried also by RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, archives there, podcast at Apple's iTunes.com. Welcome back to our program. Arnold Schwarzenegger is promoting an idea that was actually a very popular idea in Austria in the 1930s. An idea started in the 1920s by Benito Mussolini. Mussolini came, and Arnold's father, of course, even went so far as to join the Nazi party. He was so enthusiastic about this idea. Mussolini had come up with the idea of merging corporations with the state. If you merge corporations with the state, then you have an institution that will be so powerful that the government will not fall. Problem, of course, that Italy had had was that they'd had a series of governments that had not been able to hold it together. So Mussolini said, "We'll build a mighty thing by merging corporations and states," and he called this merger fascism. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, true to the traditions of his country and his father, is saying, "Hey, there's no place for unions and working people in California. It's all about corporations and merging corporate power with state power." And this has got me totally spooked. So we have with us today Steve Stallone. He's the president of the International Labor Communications Association. Their website, ilcaonline.org. And Steve has done some research here on what Arnold is up to. Hey, Steve.
Good morning, Tom.
Great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
I hope I don't sound hyperbolic by calling this fascistic. I realize people hear the word and they think of death camps and whatnot. That's not what Mussolini had in mind. When he coined the word, he was really just talking about get rid of labor unions, get rid of protections for workers, and replace the center of power in government with corporations.
Yeah, and that certainly seems to be Schwarzenegger's program. I mean, he ran for governor as a moderate Republican, but he's been ruling just like George Bush.
And in some ways even worse. I mean, Bush has not had the temerity to come forward with these kinds of propositions that Schwarzenegger has to blow unions out of the water, his Put Kids First initiative. So, in fact, let's go through these things, Steve. Illuminate us. Tell us what's this guy up to.
Sure. Well, let's just take a look at the overall picture here. I mean, this is his so-called reform agenda, which, you know, as you point out, it's a consolidation of the Republican and corporate powers to attacking unions. Schwarzenegger has come right out and said that the unions are the enemy of the state of California. They're the problem, the reason why California is having budget problems.
In fact, just for our listeners who may think that you're exaggerating, here's the exact quote. He said it on MSNBC TV. It was March 14th. He said, quote, "Get it straight. It's the unions that I am against," end quote.
Yeah.
Arnold in his own words.
Yes, indeed. And this is not just a California problem. I know that you're nationally syndicated here. You have to understand that, you know, as California goes, so goes much of the nation, and much of the nation is watching these ballot initiatives that he has raised all kinds. He raised $23 million to pay signature gatherers to put these things on the ballot, and he's raising another $50 million to put TV ads on promoting them. And he's raised much of that money outside of the state from Republican donors outside of California. So you can see that people are really looking to this as a model for a national program.
Yeah, this is going to be a litmus test. This is that's the wrong phrase. It's a prototype, I guess.
If
he can do it in California, they'll learn lessons from that, and then they'll start doing it in other states.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and he's getting a lot of this money from corporate powers, is he not?
Almost all of it. I mean, he has these $100,000 a plate fundraisers. It's just amazing. He only is raising money almost exclusively from big corporate donors.
So what is he trying to do with these propositions? First of all, they're not really, I mean, just like Bush does with his Clear Skies initiatives, that increases mercury in the air, they're not really named for what they are.
Right. And the one that's supposed to be, as you said, put kids first, has nothing to do with putting kids first. What it does is attacks the teachers and the teachers' union, and it's pure vindictiveness, because the teachers' union were the folks who stood up strongest against his attempts to cut funding for the state's public schools. What this initiative actually does is it lengthens the probationary period for teachers from 2 years to 5 years, and he's claiming that once teachers get past those 2 years, they have a job for life, and that's just not the truth. I mean, there's all kinds of provisions for teachers to be fired for poor performance, etc.
Isn't the bottom line that within 2 years, in the first 2 years that a teacher's teaching, they can be fired without a hearing?
Exactly.
And that after 2 years, you have to have a hearing, which just sort of makes sense. I mean, I think all of us would like to have a hearing before we get fired, right? And what Schwarzenegger wants to do is say, within the first 5 years, you can be fired without a hearing.
Right. And this, it's really ridiculous because at this point in California, we need like 100,000 new teachers. And what he's doing is setting up a situation where people will be discouraged to become teachers. And when you have an occupation that's already low pay and high stress, why would you try to make it more difficult for people to do this?
Now, there's a group sponsoring this and others, Proposition 75, for example, called the Coalition for Employee Rights.
Yes, which is mostly a bunch of corporate donors again and right wing activists who have suddenly decided that they're oh so concerned about workers' paychecks. And so, yes, with Prop 75, it's one of these so called paycheck protection bills.
Well, in fact, it's called the Paycheck Protection Act, is it not?
That's what it's called.
Who would be opposed to that? What a great idea. I'd like my paycheck to be protected. I think I'll vote for that. And in fact, he's going to do what?
It's what it does. It's just, it's unfair in the sense that, and unnecessary. It's unfair that only unions are being required to have these kinds of bureaucratic ways of being able to say it's okay to spend the money on politics. Corporations don't have to ask their stockholders before they make donations, but the unions now, they are requiring the unions to get a written permission from each and every member before any contribution from their dues can be used for any kind of political action.
That's really bizarre, Steve Stallone, president of the ILCA, because the last time I looked, I'm a union member, I'm a member of AFTRA, which is part of the AFL-CIO. Last time I looked, the union doesn't write my paycheck.
Right.
The corporation is absolutely unlimited in how they can pass out money to politicians. The union is going to have limits put on it, and Schwarzenegger is calling this a Paycheck Protection Act. I don't get it.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's unnecessary in that there are already legal provisions for union members to opt out of having their dues being put toward political action.
Right.
But this sets up a situation where you have to opt in, and the cost, the administrative cost of putting together a program like that would outweigh whatever contributions you would be getting from the members. It's a roundabout way of basically eliminating unions from having any political voice being able to be part of the political debate.
This is incredible. Now, this is a special off-year election. It's going to be on November 8th, isn't it?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And Schwarzenegger is pushing a whole batch of these things. Are there any good initiatives on this ballot?
Yeah, there is Proposition 79. There are two propositions that are geared toward, they're competing dual propositions on prescription drug situations.
Mm-hmm.
Schwarzenegger's not really weighing in too much on this one. One of them is done by the pharmacy companies, and the other is done by a coalition of unions and other progressive groups. But like I say, Schwarzenegger's not really weighing in too much on this one, because I think you know, neither one of these propositions would like give his bodybuilding buddies more affordable access to steroids. So
right. But basically, Proposition 79 and Proposition 80 are things that people should consider voting for, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes, 79 and 80, which is 80 is one for the to try to re-regulate California energy markets, which have gone out of,
which is a
gone crazy.
Fine idea. A fine idea. Steve Stallone, the president of the International Labor Communications Association. You can check out their website, and you can even join at ILCA Online. That's part of the URL, ilcaonline.org. Steve, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work out there advocating for the interests of all of us, not just people who have jobs that are protected by unions. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lather was 30 years old today. They took away all of his tools.
Actually, I think he's in his 50s.
His mother sent newspaper clippings to him.
No.
About his old friends who stopped being.
Actually, his mother said they were all underprivileged anyway. This is working out very well for them. It's okay. Grace Slick and Lather. Welcome back, my friends. Just a marvelous piece of music there from the old Crown of Creation album. You can tell I was a DJ back when that thing came out. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone. Actually, maybe I was doing news at the time. In any case, it was great music. Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, what's up?
Well, Tom, I was very happy that you spoke with Professor David Griffith yesterday. We live in a large apartment complex and have been passing his books an inside job around.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we have all come to blame our White House for that terrible day, along with all else that they are doing to us. It is why I tell you, they should all be locked up somewhere.
Yeah, well, Alice, in your is it 91 years of watch,
yep.
of life watching this country? I know you've seen a lot. It's funny, I got a bunch of emails after having David Ray Griffin on yesterday, some from people saying, Hartman, you've lost all credibility. You took on a conspiracy nut. How dare you? And, you know, for putting him on the air. And others saying, how come you didn't agree with him more? You know, and so, and as I've said, and you know, Alice, I am not one who, I don't entirely subscribe to David Ray Griffin's ideas, but I think that he raises important questions that have not been answered. And
that's right.
and that's my concern. I'm not ready to point fingers and say I know who did what or why or when or anything like that, but I do know that there are a lot of questions that haven't been answered. Thanks a lot, Alice.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to hear
okay.
from you.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Keep up the great work. Charlene with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. You've been with Bill Clinton today, Charlene?
That's right. Tom, good afternoon. I'm here in Gulfport, Mississippi, back down here for phase two of the Talk Radio News Relief Flash Recovery efforts down in the region. And President Clinton came to Gulfport, Mississippi today to the development nicknamed the Turnkey Development, which was actually a development of homeowners who were assisted by the federal government to purchase their homes. It's a large African-American, very successful homeownership community here that was devastated by the storm. President Clinton spent about an hour in the area talking with the residents and really getting a sense of what is happening down here and where he can best direct the Clinton-Bush fund.
So, Charlene, what is happening down there? And is this going to be private contributions that Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. have raised? Or, I mean, you know, where's our government in all this? I think a lot that we've raised, Americans have given over $1 billion to the Red Cross. But I really think that most of us, in addition to that, or, you know, in addition to the philanthropic impulse, I think most of us say, hey, you know, we pay our taxes and our government should be there for us, for the rest of us, for our brothers and sisters, regardless of where they live or what color they are, what religion or nationality, whatever. Our government should be there for us when disaster strikes. So why is our government not there? Why do there have to be any private contributions?
Well, one issue is that the federal government is not going to basically restore someone's home completely. And so private contributions are, you know, and whether or not they should or would or could have is sort of a more of a philosophical discussion, which I certainly empathize with you, Tom. But essentially what Clinton is trying to ascertain is he doesn't want to double or copy federal efforts. He wants to supplement federal efforts with these private donations, and they haven't really decided how they want to spend that money. And, of course, that's part of why I'm down here, is to basically not only determine where the money, the federal money, is best spent, but also try to direct resources to the communities I'm working with. And it was a very frank discussion. The residents were extremely articulate. I mean, again, these are working Americans who have saved their entire lives, maybe some of them the first generation of homeowners in their families. And so the president, or former president, as they call him, our president down in this part of the country, they were very encouraged, but the conversation was frank. And I think what came out of it is that what we're finding down here is really, regardless of what you think politically about faith-based initiatives or communities, the faith-based efforts here, and everybody just clapped, have been nothing short of remarkable. I mean, they really said the federal people have not been here so much, your standard organizations, aid organizations, but these faith-based communities, and like I said, we're working with the Mount Zion DeLille Methodist Church.
Right, but the faith-based community, Sholene, that you're working with is not the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, the big mega churches. We're talking here local,
right,
on-the-ground small churches, right?
Right, and people from literally, like they said, in this community, all over the country. I mean, these are really the Christians of social justice, of really the Gospels according to Christ versus more of the personal piety.
Yeah, and there are Jewish groups involved in this and Muslim groups involved in this.
Oh, absolutely, all kinds of religions, definitely. And it's, in fact, we're working with the synagogue in Baltimore that's interested in helping this Mount Zion Methodist Church. And here's really the thing is that, and this is a program that I've sort of discovered through my research, is essentially the Rural Housing Authority, the Agriculture Department, has a program that basically it helps faith-based programs target resources to the people in need for self-help and rebuilding their homes. They're looking at programs like that more and more. I think
that's great. Sholene with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for more information. Sholene, thanks a lot for being with us today. Much appreciated. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And wouldn't that be a fine thing? Welcome back. The Truth! Truth and Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Laura in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wanted to share, I totally agree with your earlier speaker with regards to the governor's union busting proposals. People should also be aware of Prop 77, which would be a mid-census redistricting of the state that is ostensibly put forward to make the state seats more competitive, but in actuality is designed to carve out additional Republican seats so that the Republicans can try to maintain a control on the House. Now, a mid-census redistricting is inherently unreliable because there's been so much population shift and movement between the census that there's no way to get an accurate count of who lives where. And so it's clearly another
Republican power grab, not unlike Tom DeLay's power grab and redistricting in Texas that we just experienced in the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, you know, welcome to Republican politics. They can't win by playing by the rules, so they have to change the rules.
And they'll keep changing them until that there's no going back.
Yeah, there
and
you go.
And I did want to offer just briefly a gentle correction. While Arnold is definitely involved in union busting, don't give President Bush a pass. And I want to remind you that after 9/11, he immediately federalized the workforce and excluded hundreds of thousands of union federal workers from collective bargaining as a masked a need to react quickly because of changing circumstances due to the terrorist attack.
Right, which was nonsense argument. And not only that, Bush has even said that he wants to take over 100,000, I believe it's over 100,000, maybe it was even 700,000 union employees, federal employees, and put them into non-union positions.
Exactly, and that must not be allowed to happen because goodbye middle class.
There you go, and that's what's been happening. Laura, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to us on Sacramento's Talk City 1290, 1240. 1240 Sacramento Talk City, KSAC, one of our newest affiliates. Patsy in Firecrest, Washington, is it, Patsy?
Yeah, that's me in Firecrest, Washington.
Hey, Patsy.
First of all, I wanted to say, I'm stuck at my dumb radio every day now from 9 to 12, and I never get anything done.
Well, and it's all my fault, right?
It's your fault.
Okay, I'm sorry, Patsy.
Okay.
But thank
you. Recently, my friend had her family come from Germany, and I got into a discussion with her brother about German politics.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about Mussolini today.
Yeah.
But what he was saying to me was kind of interesting. He got into talking about Hitler. And he said that the way Hitler took over Germany was through their Patriot Act.
Yes, it was called the law for the protection, the patriotic law for the protection of Germans.
Right.
And it had such odious provisions in it. It allowed the police to open people's mail without a warrant. It allowed them to sneak into people's homes without a warrant. It allowed them to tap people's telephones. It basically contained all the provisions of the Patriot Act. And it was so offensive to many of the legislators that they put a 4-year sunset provision on it. And, you know, it's almost like the guys who wrote the Patriot Act were, you know, reading William Shurer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. It's absolutely spooky. In fact, I wrote a piece about this, Patsy. If you go to TomHartmann.com and click on Articles on Democracy,
okay,
and scroll down a little bit, there's an article called When Democracy Failed. And it is the history of the collapse of democracy in Germany and its parallels to America.
Yeah, it was a very interesting conversation.
It is absolutely fascinating.
But, and also, he said the Germans are worried because now we've got this Bush trying to put in the military to get bird flu.
Yeah, I think I just dumped I think I just dumped your phrase there, Patsy.
I'm glad.
hopefully we deleted it. I got to the button as quickly as I could. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Interesting. And to talk about presidential power being exercised and all that, Bush out of the blue starts talking about the bird flu pandemic from Asia coming over to this country. And it's amazing he starts talking about this. I swear to God, during last year's presidential election, the only one that was talking about this bird flu thing at all was Ralph Nader.
Yeah.
I don't remember anyone else ever bringing this up.
Yeah, and this is not a surprise. Well said, Joe. And the Wall Street Journal a year ago, I was talking on this program about how the Wall Street Journal was talking about the bird flu and how it might be a good time to buy Tamiflu, which is an antiviral drug. And basically saying to all the rich folks who read the Wall Street Journal, hey, you know, time to stock up on the Tamiflu because there might be a pandemic coming. And now all the Tamiflu's gone. I guess they, you know, all the rich folks have bought up all they can. And so it's just not available. And the Bush administration, what are they doing in response to the possibility of a bird flu epidemic? Are they out there saying, hey, let's start manufacturing Tamiflu here in the United States? Because there's only one factory that makes it. It's in Switzerland. Saying, you know, shall we make this? No, they're not doing that. No, instead, Bush wants to increase the power of the army. Increase the power of the army.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Could it be? Is everything you know is wrong? It did the Bush administration attack the peace movement with military-grade biological warfare agents? This sounds nutty. Bob Fitrakis wrote in the Free Press, freepress.org, he said this, Saturday, October 1st, Washington Post headline. This was the Washington Post. Poison found in air during anti-war protest. As Greg Payne said in the Washington Post article, he's the Washington, D.C. public health director. Why that day? That's not explained. Just that 24-hour period, none since. There are these detectors for biological agents all around Washington, D.C., in case anybody were to ever try and, you know, launch a biological warfare attack against, you know, the Congress, the president, against Washington. They've got these secret sensors all over the place. And on the day that all those the 500,000 peace demonstrators showed up in Washington, D.C., and just on that day, those detectors all went nuts. Because the biohazard sensors were detecting tularemia bacteria. Tularemia, also known as rabbit flu. The Washington, D.C. public health director, Greg Payne, says it was puzzling that the finding was from that day, from a day when the mall was packed with people. Because people don't carry this bacteria. People can get sick from it. You spray it in somebody's face, and they will come down with the rabbit flu, but they're not contagious to other people. They just get sick from it and fight it off. It's sort of like having a bad case of the flu. You get chills and aches and fever, and your muscles hurt, and you just feel awful for a couple of days. It comes on 3 to 5 days later. Now, keep in mind, there were a few things that happened that weekend. Equally puzzling, notes Bob Fitrakis, was an earlier Post report. Weekend protesters hit travel snags. That article reported that Amtrak trains from New York City were turned back, canceled, or delayed from heading to the nation's capital for the biggest peace demonstration since the Vietnam War era. And Metro subway cars coming into the capital were disrupted by repairs. Now, it turns out, when they started looking into what is this tularemia bacteria that was found in large quantities all over the mall where these hundreds of thousands of people were, and yet it's impossible that anybody could have brought it in because people don't carry the bacteria. It would have to have been released. Turns out it's one of six major bacterial bioterrorism agents. The BBC says tularemia is one of the most infectious germs known to science. It takes just 10 microbes to bring on disease in humans. It emerged as a, quote, plague-like disease, end quote, during a 1911 outbreak of rabbit fever in Tulare Lake in California. That's why the name tularemia. The disease progresses rapidly in humans, with patients suffering from headache, fatigue, dizziness, muscle pains, loss of appetite, and nausea. Progresses to inflamed and reddened face and eyes. It attacks the lymph nodes and glands. It can be life-threatening. Fortunately, it almost never happens in nature. It's very rare. Unfortunately, writes Bob Fitrakis, tularemia has long been used as a military biological weapon. The idea is you spray the enemy army with it, and it doesn't kill them. They don't, you know, there's no big freak out like, oh my God, it's a biological war. It's just like everybody gets what they think is the flu, an incredibly bad case of it. This stuff is a military biological weapon. What is it doing being sprayed on people or distributed somehow all over the peace demonstrators in Washington, D.C.? The Japanese germ warfare units operating in Manchuria between 1932 and 1935, in fact, used tularemia against the Chinese, a way of incapacitating civilian and military populations. They just, you know, spray it from an airplane and most everybody gets sick. They don't get sick right away. It takes about a week. What's going on? Why did these detectors go off in Washington, D.C.? You know, we still haven't found out who mailed the anthrax bacteria. And the anthrax only went to Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. The only two guys in the Senate who could have blocked the Patriot Act, which was before them at the time. Pat Leahy was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which could have blocked the Patriot Act. And Tom Daschle was the head of the Senate Democrats, who controlled the Senate for that brief period of time when Jim Jeffords decided he wasn't a Republican anymore. It's enough to make you scratch your head. It's enough to make you wonder if David Ray Griffin may be onto something. Although, as I said, I'm not ready to go that far, but I sure am willing to raise these questions. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. It's a beautiful day. Sky
falls, you feel like it's a beautiful day. And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. You want to be accurate about it if you're setting the digital clock on your dashboard or in your home. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. There's a group that is trying to raise money to push for an inquiry into the Downing Street documents, actually to hire a pollster to do a poll, because nobody will ask this question in a national poll. ABC won't, CBS won't, and CNN won't, the New York Times won't, the Washington Post won't ask the question, do you think Bush should be impeached? Nobody has ever asked that question in a national poll. Now, his ratings are below where Clinton's were, and everybody was enthusiastic to ask, do you think Clinton should be impeached? Those polls were done over and over and over again. But for some reason, the polling companies are saying, you know, this isn't a question that we should ask. And so there's now an effort out there to raise the money for it. And afterdowningstreet.org, I believe, is the website where you can find out more information about that. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Glenn in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, on the line. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to share something with you. You know, when I think back to the 2000 elections and, you know, how it was up in the air, who was the actual winner, you know, and it was all this arguing going on and all that.
Sure.
And was paying attention to it and everything, and I was saying, well, you know, they're going to count via votes, and whoever wins, wins. But when the Supreme Court came down and basically said, stop the vote count and, you know, awarded the presidency to Bush, I had a very...
Do you remember the rationale that they gave for that? If you go back, you can read it online. It's a fascinating reading. Bush v. Gore is the case. It's a Supreme Court case. And first of all, they said, Rehnquist said in his majority opinion, he said, this is not precedent. In other words, this case stands alone. We're doing something weird here. Don't ever consider this in the future as law. Okay, first of all, he said that. Secondly, the reason that they said that they were stopping the vote count was because if the count was allowed to continue, it would cause, and I'm quoting, irreparable harm to the plaintiff. End quote, which, of course, was George W. Bush. In other words, if the vote was counted in Florida, it would cause Bush irreparable harm. That was the rationale the Supreme Court used to award the presidency to George W. Bush.
Right, and I remember that statement, but what made it feel so foreboding to me was that I always thought that as an American that your vote always counted, okay? So we know it came down to Florida. And, you know, my parents had always told me that if you want to change what's going on in your country, get out and vote, you know. And so when the 2004 election came around, you know, me and perhaps, you know, tens of millions of Americans thought, yes, let's go and let's vote and let's get involved and we can get these guys out of office. Well, lo and behold, voting shenanigans happen in Ohio, you know, and so it just makes me think that, you know, the people that are in power right now, they have consolidated power illegally, and they've learned from history from the standpoint that everything that kept them out of power in the past, they're going to make sure that that doesn't keep them out of power in the present and perhaps in the future. So
it does seem like that's happening, Glenn. Then you get the former Enron lobbyist, $700,000 a year lobbyist and head of the RNC, Ed Gillespie, coming out after the election in 2004 saying we shouldn't have exit polls anymore. There should be a federal ban on exit polls, which, by the way, the Baker-Carter Commission just recommended, banning exit polls, or banning releasing the information from exit polls until after the electronic voting machines have been counted, so that the polls can be recalibrated, right? So we shouldn't have exit polls because in 2000, in 2002, and in 2004, the exit polls showed that the Democrats won, but the electronic voting machines all said the Republicans won, and this is dispiriting Republicans. This is what former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie, head of the RNC, said at the time. It's mind-boggling. By the way, the Constitution doesn't guarantee your right to vote for president. That's the Electoral College, and you don't even have a right to vote for the Electoral College. The state determines how the Electoral College is picked. It's just that all the states right now do use a vote to pick it, but historically that wasn't always the case. Sometimes states did it with their legislatures, or sometimes the governors appointed the electors. Let's see, is it Jerry in Edwardsville, Illinois? Am I reading that right?
Yeah, Tom.
Hey, Jerry.
I just wanted to say one more thing. The other day you were talking about those Democratic airplanes going down. And when you said that, I recall back in the 70s.
But the Democratic airplane. Oh, you mean Paul Wellstone?
Wellstone and Mel Carnahan in
right.
Missouri.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s, Jerry Linton had won the Democratic primary for the Senate. And he was about 30 points ahead statewide. And the night
in what
he
state?
Won, his plane went down.
In what state?
Missouri.
Okay.
Went down in good weather the night he had won the primary. And at that time, that just struck me as I couldn't believe that could happen.
Yeah.
Carnahan's plane was in the rain. I understand that's a different problem. But also, Senator Kennedy's plane went down. So,
well, you know, Ted Kennedy was supposed to be on the plane with Paul Wellstone, and he showed up late, so they didn't take him.
I didn't know that.
And that would have flipped the Senate then and there.
That is a real ouch.
Yeah, it's pretty spooky. And again, I don't have a conspiracy theory to offer on this one. I think it's a terrible tragedy. I thought it was amazing that after Mel Carnahan died, that John Ashcroft, who was running against him for the Senate, still lost. John Ashcroft in Missouri lost against a dead guy.
He was very unpopular.
Yeah, to say the very least. So they had to find something else for him to do, put him in charge of the Justice Department. But I remember when I was learning to be a pilot, I got my pilot's license back in the early 70s, that we would do instrument flight training. And one of the little tricks that my instructor liked to do was you get basically a refrigerator magnet and flip it up there underneath the panel. And there's a couple of places where you can put a little magnet, and it'll cause some of your instruments to be just a little bit off. So you end up not quite where you thought you were going to end up as you pop out of the clouds. Who knows? I don't know. Like I said, I don't have a theory on that one. I just think it's a tragedy. But I do think that we should have some fairly thorough investigations of them. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks so much for being with us today. Another 3 hours of the program. We will see you tomorrow, same time, same place, here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us, where we help you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.